I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Sunday is Mother's Day, a bittersweet day for mothers and families of sons sentenced to life in prison. Even though the U.S. Supreme Court has declared mandatory life without parole unconstitutional for teens, many families are still waiting for their day in court. Some in Philadelphia are calling on lawmakers to act, as WHYY's Bobby Allen reports.
Kimberly King's calling for compassion. And when she talks about it, the number 22 has special meaning. Her older brother was 22 when he was sentenced to life in prison, and her little brother was murdered at 22. The separate incidents both happened in West Philly.
It may seem as if the healing comes from seeing the perpetrator put away, but it does nothing.
She says when someone's convicted of murder, they should be put away for a long time.
But to completely condemn them to death, I think that's wrong.
Her older brother, Terrell Carter, is now 47. He's an author and teaches classes to other inmates in prison. She says they talk on the phone every day.
He could be doing so much more outside than he's doing inside. So it's a waste of a human life.
Pennsylvania's tough-on-crime laws have given the state more juvenile lifers than any place else. In Philly alone, some 300 prisoners now qualify for new sentencing hearings after the two recent U.S. Supreme Court cases. The high court said that mandatory life without parole isn't allowed, but that still gives prosecutors the power to lock up a murder suspect for life in some cases. After the event, the mothers marched to the district attorney's office and delivered the city's top prosecutor, Seth Williams, a Mother's Day card. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
In Philadelphia, a city concentrated with children struggling to cope with trauma and stress, the path to academic success can be steep. WHYY's Kevin McCory takes us inside a public school where educators are trying to implement new theories against overwhelming odds.
School counselor Pam Turner Bunyan had been warned. This new incoming student was prone to very erratic behavior.
When he first came to us, he ran out of the building the first day, very first day. Instead of coming in, he ran.
She immediately took off, dashing out into the crime-prone streets that surround the school.
I found out that he was running, so I went and chased him down and coaxed him back in.
Turner Bunyan has 15 years under her belt as counselor at Feltonville Intermediate, a Philadelphia public school serving grades 3, 4, and 5, where most students come from low-income families. Years ago, in the same situation, she would have reacted differently, maybe gotten angry, and tried to lecture the student sternly about his misbehavior. But that was before she learned about trauma-informed care.
It's saying, what can we do to intentionally work with children and minimize the stress so that then children are able to think and function in school?
For Turner Bunyan, it's about empathy and finding strategies that work for each student.
And so for him, it was trying to figure out a safe spot that he could go to, that he could feel alone, and that he could escape. And one of the things that we found out really quickly, he and I did, was that he really likes to read.
But what works for one child doesn't for another. She has many students who live the depths of poverty, kids who've recently had close family members who've suffered sudden, violent deaths, others who've been the ones to find the bodies of relatives who've committed suicide. Like the child who sought refuge in running, many of these students struggle to focus in school, and their stressed-out lives break out in the classroom.
A kid will be throwing a desk and throwing a chair, and I will have to go up and get them. It's real crisis stuff.
But over time, Turner Bunyan has learned how to quickly de-escalate these situations, often by engaging students' senses.
I have students that come in that, for example, need hugs in the morning. So I give them hugs, you know, and you can see that totally, just that hug changes their ability to be able to function.
Turner Bunyan learned about many of these practices through training provided by the school district, training that's guided by the work of one of the top researchers in the field, Drexel University's Sandra Bloom.
The same areas of the brain that we need for performing academically are the parts of the brain often that are most negatively impacted by toxic stress.
Bloom has been on the forefront of scholarship that delves into the effects of what are known as adverse childhood experiences, which can literally change the way the brain is wired.
Now, because of research that's been done, we understand that exposure to all different kinds of adversity in childhood can produce lots of health, mental health, and social problems in adulthood. And that may seem kind of obvious, but we haven't, until quite recently, had the science to back it up.
The Adverse Childhood Experiences, or ACEs, study was first performed in San Diego in 1998. It found a staggering correlation between the extent of experiences like abuse and neglect in childhood and rates of early death, substance abuse, and other crippling ailments later on. Overcoming the effects of trauma, which are often amplified and exacerbated by poverty, is no small feat, but Bloom says schools should be primed to take on this responsibility.
But to do that, we have to understand that education needs to be more than reading, writing, and arithmetic, that we really need to help kids develop socially and emotionally as well if we want them to have good academic performance.
But that will take rethinking the way we see misbehavior in school. Kids who live in a relentlessly stressful condition can become trapped in a state of fight or flight. That blocks cognitive ability and gives kids a hair trigger response system. So seemingly little things can blow up into disruptive incidents. But when teachers and counselors take the time to ease student stress, Bloom says over time it can be a major boon to overall health.
And those can then become basically therapeutic experiences for those kids.
But to train all teachers to do this will take a gigantic commitment to addressing the issue and the resources to back it up. A very challenging prospect for a perpetually cash-strapped public school system like Philadelphia.
Oh, that's a definite big thing, you know, because I'm the only counselor here for 700-plus students.
At Feltonville Intermediate, Turner Bunyan knows those challenges all too well.
There's no roadmap here. We're kind of creating our own as we go along.
As costly as it could be to use this approach district-wide, Sandra Bloom says it would be well worth the investment.
Right now, we might as well just put our national wealth on a bonfire and just set it alight, because we're wasting all this money later on health care and mental health care and social services and suffering that doesn't have an economic figure attached that really we wouldn't have to if we just take care of kids.
Kevin McCory, WHYY News.
Let's look at what a Republican apparent nominee, Donald Trump, versus a Democratic likely nominee, Hillary Clinton, presidential candidate matchup looks like from the public point of view with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, Frank, we know it would be historic. Clinton, the first woman representing a major party. Donald Trump, the first non-politician since Dwight Eisenhower ran 64 years ago. What else is historic about this contest?
Well, some people have opined that we have more unfavorables out here for these two candidates than ever has been the case in history. Two more unpopular candidates. I hear that a lot on television. But we're close to that. Maybe a little truth to it, but I would say we have to be somewhat cautious. In 1992 is the election I would point to. George H.W. Bush, Bush Sr., at one point during that election had an unfavorable that was up in the 57% range, his image. And Bill Clinton, before he turned it around in the summer, that would have been young Bill Clinton, Arkansas governor running for president on the Democratic side, he had an unfavorable that was as high as almost 50%, 49%. So you've got those two candidates with pretty high unfavorables, which are not too far off from where Trump is today and where Hillary Clinton is today in terms of their unfavorables.
Because Hillary Clinton is such a known entity, and similarly Donald Trump has been in the public eye for so long, is it likely that perceptions about the candidates can change between now and November, or are they hardened?
Oh, I would say absolutely they can change. Again, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton's husband, is a great example. He was viewed more unfavorably than favorably in early 1992. He was underwater, as we say, on his image. But then in the summer, they had a very positive Democratic convention, and Ross Perot dropped out of the race, and suddenly Bill Clinton's favorable image just flipped, and he was seen as a very positive individual. And at the same time in 92, George H.W. Bush, was quite popular earlier in the year, but by the fall, he was very unpopular with very high unfavorable ratings. So history shows that things can change. Mitt Romney had a fairly negative image at points back when he was running as the nominee in 2012, and he became more positive as the election went on.
Let me gently persist. The public sees both as having personality and character issues. Can they change as well?
Well, that's an interesting question as well. I think Hillary Clinton's image is certainly more solidified in the minds of the average American than Donald Trump, simply because she's been around so much longer than he has in the public eye, 25 years or more if you go back to when she first came on the scene in 1992. When you ask Americans what comes to mind first about Hillary Clinton, it is dishonest, worried about her ethics, and that's exactly what we found when we asked similar questions about her in the past, going all the way back when she was running in 2008. So you just don't see a lot of change there. Trump, well, his image now is also around personality issues. He's impulsive. He's wild. He's arrogant. Those are the kind of things that come through now when we talk about Trump. But since he has not been on the political stage as long as she has, I think it's possible that his image could change more likely than it would be that hers could change.
Any sense at this juncture of the appetite or enthusiasm for the contest?
Right now, we are finding that Republicans are more enthusiastic than Democrats, and we are also finding that men are more enthusiastic than women.
Is that typical?
Well, Democrats certainly not having the same level of enthusiasm as Republicans is more typical. That's the classic turnout problem. Republicans are more likely to turn out than Democrats across many, many, many elections and over many, many, many years. We'll see if that changes. We think part of the reason right now women have been less interested is because everything's been dominated by Donald Trump over on the right-hand side, the Republican side of the ledger. So we'll see if that changes. I think that's a real key for the Clinton camp. They're going to have to generate the kind of enthusiasm, which translates into turnout, that Barack Obama has been able to generate in the last two elections.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Still ahead.
More bike lanes mean safer streets.
Well, from your point of view, yes.
Can the Bicycle Coalition and Stu Bykofsky mend their differences in time for tomorrow's charity ride? Find out as Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. For years, the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia and Daily News columnist Stu Bykofsky have openly sparred over how much of the city's streets should be devoted to bicycles. So naturally, they're putting on a charity bike ride together tomorrow. The unlikely pairing came about when a bicycle advocate contacted Bykofsky after appearing in his column. WHYY's Peter Crimmins asked Bykofsky and Randy Labasso from the Bicycle Coalition to explain.
So how did that encounter turn into a ride?
Then it just sort of organically bubbled up, like, how would you like to lead a bike ride of a bunch of people? And I said, the only way I would do something like that is if we follow all of the rules, because my big complaint with bicyclists is they break the law. They all go through red lights. Upwards of 90% of them go through red lights. They treat stop signs as yields. Too many of them ride on the sidewalk, all of which are violations of law. So I said, okay, if we're going to do this bike ride, we're going to follow all the rules, okay? Okay, okay. And then I said, well, if we're going to do it, I'm just not going to do it like for the fun of doing it. There's got to be a charity component. I want to raise money for some good cause. I elected to use the People's Emergency Center.
What makes this ride curious to a lot of people, I think, certainly curious to us here, is that Stu Bykofsky and the greater bicycle community sort of had an open argument for years over biking in the city, the Bicycle Coalition being part of it. And so it's curious that these two entities have come together to commonly do something.
Since I started at the Bicycle Coalition, I've always wanted to open conversation with anyone who's willing to have one with me, because I understand that some people have their problems with bicyclists. The Stu brought up this 90% of cyclists break the laws thing. That's not proven, but, you know, it's something we can talk about. And I think that the more people see bicyclists on the street, the more people are willing to actually bicycle themselves, the more they see some of the problems with bicycling in the city.
I'm wondering if on what points of biking in the city does the Bicycle Coalition and Stu Boykowski come to agreement on?
We agree the law should be obeyed, both of us.
I think we are in 90% agreement on most things. The Bicycle Coalition believes that there should be better enforcement of all traffic in the city. There's not enough enforcement and there's not enough education as to the rules of the road and where bicyclists belong, where cars belong, et cetera. And the Bicycle Coalition is working on changing that.
Yeah.
As regards enforcement, once a year I do a column in which I detail the number of tickets that have been written for bicyclists, pedestrians, and motorists. The motorists, I'm working from memory, don't hold me to this, is 80,000 tickets are written for motorists in 2015. 14 were written for bicyclists. 90 were written for pedestrians. More jaywalkers got tickets than bicyclists. There is no enforcement on bicycles.
Well, the other thing is, and something that you have found, there's been no enforcement on cars parked in bike lanes as well. Illegal parking is a big problem for cyclists. We have having to jet out into traffic after being in a bike lane to avoid a car or a truck or a UPS truck is dangerous.
Well, let me interject that I don't want bike lanes on Spruce and Pine because they're virtually unused except in rush hour.
Okay, that's not true, but okay, yeah.
Okay. I have no objections to them on JFK and Delaware and Market. If it's a wide street and basically you're still leaving the motorists with what their, quote, share of the road. So this is something the Bicycle Coalition and I disagree on, the need for bike lanes. And also the city is being very underhanded and sneaky in trying to roll them out. A couple of years ago, they were prevented from the streets department, I guess, was prevented from just designating streets for bike lanes. They have to have the approval of the city council person of that district. Bicycle Coalition hated that. They don't want the city council person to be able to say yes or no because I think the Bicycle Coalition knows the majority of people in the neighborhood don't want it.
So, all right, that's not true either.
That's opinion.
Okay, fine. But what's actually the case is that certain streets were designated for bike lanes based on safety and based on whether or not traffic would be affected. They're announced way beforehand, put on the streets department website. Then neighborhoods can debate on them. And we are not in favor of city council people basing their idea of safety over an actual studied idea of safety.
Mm-hmm. It's not a matter of safety. It's a matter of do the people who live in that community have a say of what happens to their streets?
Well, it is a matter of safety because more bike lanes mean safer streets.
Mm-hmm. well, from your point of view, yes.
I'm sorry, but we do have to – we're getting this signal. We do have to cut off.
It's going to be a fun ride.
All right. So I want to thank Stu Boykowski, Randy Labasso from the Bicycle Coalition. I want to thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure.
If you believe the greeting card industry, motherhood is marked by unconditional love and sacrifice. Now for a slightly different take on mothers, we turn to The Onion. In March, the Idiopathic Ridiculopathy Consortium, Philadelphia's theater troupe dedicated to absurdist literature, staged an evening of dramatic readings from The Onion. From that show, here's Sharon Geller with her thoughts on being a mom.
Thank you for inviting me to speak tonight on the joys of parenting. Having a child can be the most transformative experience in your life. You get so used to living your life a certain way, focus solely on your job, your social life, your personal goals. And then just like that, it all changes. Well, that's what happened to me 10 years ago when I had my daughter Jane. Up until that moment, I never in a million years thought I could love anyone almost as much as I love myself. As soon as the nurse put her in my arms, that beautiful baby girl became the second most important thing in my life. In an instant, I went from caring only about myself to caring about myself plus one other person. All my other priorities but one flew right out the window. My daughter has been an additional consideration in my life ever since that time. When Jane first came into this world, I wanted to do so much for her. You know, I wanted to give her everything that I could without sacrificing too much of my own free time or compromising any of my own personal goals. That indescribable sensation of looking into those deep, big, beautiful brown eyes for the first time made me realize that I would do anything except risk my own life to protect her. That's how much he means to me. Every time I see the way her eyes light up when she smiles, or the way her cheeks puff up when she gets a little bit upset, I see some of myself in her. Oh, and that is the part I really love. There's just something very special about carrying around a little person inside of you for 9 months. It forges a unique bond that truly can never be broken unless you've got something else going on in your life that's just as important and takes precedence over it. And that is why I would not trade any of the time that I spend with Jane for anything unless I really wanted to. It's a wonderful feeling to know that no one, and I mean absolutely no one, comes between me and my daughter except me. Well, if you're already a parent, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And if not, you'll find out one day when you become one. Suddenly, it's not all about you anymore, but it's still mostly about you. Thank you.
Sharon Geller, musing about motherhood from the Idiopathic Ridiculopathy Consortium's readings of stories from The Onion. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production help this week from Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Adam Stanishevsky and Diana Martinez. John Mussoni is acting vice president of News and Civic Dialogue. Thanks for joining us, and don't forget to treat your mom this Sunday. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight. I never understood how mama made